Welcome to Politicology. I'm Ron Steslow. When most people hear spying, they think of James Bond sneaking into a secret facility and copying the data off of a hard drive, or agents holed up in a surveillance van, spending days listening to their target's conversation, or maybe Sydney Bristow tailing her target to learn where a covert base is. It's a lot of hacking and hustling, but what if I told you you didn't need to hack a computer to get the data? You just need a credit card or a government expense account. Every day, you're generating thousands of pieces of data: where you are, what numbers you call, how long each phone call is, what websites you visit. Information that, if the right person looks, can give away where you live and where you work, whether you've had a heart attack, whether you're seeking an abortion. And because you're probably the only one who spends almost every night in your house and then drives to your office every day, it's not difficult at all to trace all of that data back to you. Not some anonymized collection of data points. All of this data is for sale, and some of the biggest customers buying it all up are three-letter agencies inside the federal government who are prohibited by law from collecting it themselves. Today, we're pulling back the curtain on this secretive industry, how opaque these systems are, why these surveillance agencies are working hard to make sure you don't know about it, and what you can do about it. There's no one better to unpack all of this than Byron Tao. Byron is the author of Means of Control: How the Hidden Alliance of Tech and Government is Creating a New American Surveillance State. He's also an investigative reporter and enterprise journalist who specializes in law, courts, and national security. Currently, he works at the All Britain Journalism Institute, a journalism nonprofit that trains and mentors early career reporters and writes for their publication, Notice. Previously, he worked at Wall Street Journal and Politico. At the Journal, he covered the White House during the Obama administration. He covered Congress with a focus on the Intelligence, Oversight, and Judiciary Committees. He was also a legal affairs and national security correspondent. And at Politico, he covered the White House, lobbying, campaign finance, and politics. You mentioned Ron Wyden, who's a Democratic senator from Oregon and sits on the Intelligence Committee. He plays a pretty prominent role in the book, and if you're a privacy advocate, or if any of this just generally concerns you, he comes across as quite a hero. One vignette in particular, you wrote about a Senate Intel hearing in March of 2013, which was before Edward Snowden had revealed that the government was secretly collecting data on millions of Americans, where Wyden asks James Clapper, who was then President Obama's Director of National Intelligence. I'll just play the exchange. It's quite stunning.
On the surveillance front, and I hope we can do this in just a yes or no answer, because I know Senator Feinstein wants to move on. Last summer, the NSA director was at a conference, and he was asked a question about the NSA surveillance of Americans. He replied, and I quote here, "The story that we have millions or hundreds of millions of dossiers on people is completely false." The reason I'm asking the question is, having served on the committee now for a dozen years, I don't really know what a dossier is in this context. So what I wanted to see is if you could give me a yes or no answer to the question, does the NSA collect any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans?
No, sir.
It does not.
Not wittingly. There are cases where they could inadvertently, perhaps, collect, but not wittingly.
All right, he says. This was an outright lie at a congressional hearing, and everyone at the witness table knew it, and everyone on the committee knew it, and none of them could say it. Moreover, there don't seem to have been any consequences for Clapper perjuring himself in sworn testimony before Congress, which is, you know, essentially the same thing we impeached President Clinton for. Can you talk about the extent to which the government has tried to hide these programs?
Sure. So in this instance, Clapper was talking about a classified program that Edward Snowden later revealed that showed that indeed the United States government was collecting all of the phone records of every American to see who we were dialing, potentially with the idea of mapping out our social networks and figuring out which Americans were in contact with terrorist targets overseas. But, you know, you know, that's a genuine classified program. Clapper has given various explanations for why he, answered that way. He's blamed a memory lapse or said that was the best way to give an answer in an unclassified setting. Critics have said he outright lied to the committee and that he deserves to be prosecuted. But the government's reticence to talk about the ways in which it's collecting large amounts of information on the global population goes far beyond classified programs. Like, much of what I wrote about in the book is technically unclassified, right? Because we're talking about data that's available for sale. Most of these programs that rely on consumer data, they might be sensitive, but most of this wasn't classified. Yet time and time again in trying to do this reporting, both the government vendors and the government itself did not really want to talk about the ways in which they were acquiring this data. Yet at the same time, government lawyers had blessed these programs under the legal theory that people had consented to the data's collection and that it was a simple commercial transaction. Well, it's hard to be both, right? It's hard to say that people have opted into this kind of data sharing and fully recognize the consequences, but also that we don't want to talk about these programs because, you know, then bad guys will change their patterns or habits or routines, or they'll ditch their phone. So that's the paradox at the heart of the government's position here, right? That they, on the one hand, want to rely on this notion that everyone has agreed to some terms of service that allow this data to be sold. On the other hand, you know, these tools and techniques are just simply too sensitive to talk about. And we couldn't possibly brief journalists and civil society about what exactly we're doing with large amounts of data.
I mean, for me, it truly breaks credulity, the contradiction inherent in the government's position. Can you talk a little bit about how Edward Snowden changed the way these programs are conducted and how things changed after his revelation?
Sure. So Edward Snowden, I think, grounds this part of the book because it's something that everyone's heard of, and it was a moment in which the global population paid attention to something that they really hadn't been paying attention to before, which is, these surveillance programs that governments were running in the shadows. And so Snowden revealed all of the ways in which the US and its allies, Canada, the UK, and New Zealand and Australia, were obtaining huge amounts of internet data. They were tapping things like fiber optic cables. They were compelling tech companies like Google and Facebook to turn over data under secret warrants that these companies could never reveal to the public. And ultimately, they were also hacking into things like computer systems and devices and phones to collect huge amounts of information. So Snowden really gives us a window into the ways in which modern surveillance operated, at least as of 2013. You know, tech companies, seeing a lot of the reporting, started making changes in the ways their products function, right? So a lot of tech companies began adding what's called encryption to the data that they send along the internet. This means that someone who's tapping a fiber optic cable can no longer see that kind of what the actual information is, right? So it's protected in transit as it goes along the fiber optic cable between New York and London. So governments were losing a lot of visibility into what was happening on the web because consumer companies were upset about government surveillance. Well, this had the inadvertent effect of making it actually more attractive to simply buy this data from some sort of a willing vendor that would sell it to you, right? In the pre-Snowden era, governments could get advertising data just by tapping the backbone of the internet because advertisers didn't bother to encrypt anything they were sending between phones and their ad servers. But after Snowden, all sorts of companies add encryption to their products, and so they can no longer do that. But there are these data brokers, these vendors out there that are willing to sell the exact same data to governments for whatever purpose government wanted it for.
I want to bookmark a question about encryption for a few minutes from now. But one of the things that jumped out at me in these programs is that they went on for a long time without any real legal review. In my notes, as I mentioned, I had quite a few holy shit moments, and one of them, which I wrote down, was when you wrote about data from Ventel spreading like wildfire through Department of Homeland Security without ever clearing it with their privacy and legal team. Eventually, DHS decides that this is kosher because end users were opting in, quote unquote, opting in to sharing their data, which turned out to be a lie. Can you explain how that happened? What allowed that to happen?
Yeah, so some of these vendors come into government and they get set up in pilot programs or, you know, these experimental collaborations. And in this instance, it seems they seem to have bypassed the privacy office, which at some point a year or so after these so-called experiments started, got wind of exactly what DHS was doing. They were buying large amounts of movement data of hundreds of millions of phones, including many in the United States. And someone in that office basically said, has anyone checked if this is legal? Has anyone drawn up a policy, a privacy policy around use of this kind of information? You know, this isn't exactly uncommon. This, you know, the same sort of thing happened with the FBI with a different program. You know, they decided to join this program that was being run as an interagency collaboration or experiment and started using the data domestically. And then they backed out, right? Because there were concerns among lawyers and other officials that, you know, is this appropriate? Is this lawful? And so a lot of times these tools can find their way into government without high-level approval or legal review because they're simply tools, they're licenses. And sometimes field agents or field offices can get set up with one without the, you know, the lawyers at headquarters fully being briefed or understanding what exactly is happening.
I want to talk about, as I mentioned, encryption for just a moment, because there's a really telling backstory to encryption, which I don't think you talk about in the book, but I'm sure you're very well aware of. And maybe you could tell folks how we got it in the first place, because I think the story of encryption shows the hostility from the government toward users trying to protect themselves. And you know, they're coming at this from a national security perspective, which is what a lot of the reasoning is behind what they're doing now. So there's a guy named Phil Zimmerman who created a program called Pretty Good Privacy, PGP, which is an encryption, a piece of encryption software in 1991. And this piece of software allowed individuals to securely encrypt emails and files using public key cryptography. So after its creation, he wants to distribute it freely on the internet for anybody to use and just empower ordinary citizens to protect their privacy. The U.S. government investigates him for potential violation of ITAR, which is the International Traffic in Arms Regulations, which at the time included cryptographic software in its definition of munitions, which therefore restricted its export without a license. So this investigation centers on the fact that PGP had spread internationally, effectively exporting it without government approval. And in response to these legal challenges, and to highlight the absurdity of the regulations, Zimmerman publishes the source code in a physical book. And this basically leveraged the protection of free speech for printed material, contrasting it with restrictions on software. And the rationale was obviously that books enjoy protected status under the First Amendment. And exporting books, even those that contain cryptographic source code, should not be restricted in the same way as software. So, you know, later on, we get Bernstein v. the United States. Daniel Bernstein was a student at Berkeley. He then went on to teach at University of Illinois. And he wanted to publish a paper and associated source code on an encryption program that he wrote called Snuffle. The government had placed encryption, as I said, on the United States munitions list as a weapon. And anybody trying to export items on the munitions list again, including software that could encrypt things, needed prior approval from the State Department. And the Ninth Circuit ruled that software source code was speech protected by the First Amendment. And this was a sort of landmark decision that is relied upon to this day to protect computer code. So these two stories, to me, paint a picture of a general attitude on the government side against individuals trying to protect themselves. So tell me about the NSA's program.
Yeah, so it's definitely true that encryption for a long time was viewed as a threat to the government's ability to run public safety and intelligence programs. For a while in the 1990s, there was this ability to encrypt phone calls, but the government was worried about not being able to listen in when criminals use the telephone. And so there was a technology called the Clipper chip, right, that would be put into telephone systems that actually had a backdoor to allow the government to listen in on phone calls, but also allowed encryption under normal circumstances. It turned out that not very many people wanted a government backdoor in their phone, and the primary users of the Clipper chip were government entities, right? So they were putting their own Clipper chip thing in their own telephone systems because they were the only ones who really wanted a backdoor. But, you know, over time, this debate has largely been settled in favor of the civil libertarians. And today, encryption is widely deployed in many contexts in order to protect user privacy. Almost everything nowadays that goes over the web is at the very least encrypted in transit, meaning that it's very difficult to extract it as it's moving along a fiber optic cable. But on the other hand, you know, services like Google or Facebook or other private messaging services, right? Like your private messages on Facebook Messenger or your emails on Google. Google and Facebook do have backdoor access to your content and can provide it to the government under some circumstances. But increasingly, we are seeing consumer technology that does put communications beyond the reach of governments in some ways. We are seeing services like ProtonMail spring up to offer what's called end-to-end encrypted email, which means not even ProtonMail can see what you're emailing with other ProtonMail users. Or Signal has become a very popular messenger service. And part of the appeal of Signal is that it's very difficult to intercept. Not even Signal knows what you're sending. Apple's iMessage, one of the most widely used platforms in the world for texting. When you have a little blue bubble with another Apple user on your iPhone, that's actually encrypted. Apple doesn't know what you're saying in that conversation. So there has been this explosion of encryption in consumer services in the past 10, 20 years. But a lot of the things I describe in my book are actually sort of metadata, data that's not exactly content, it's some other kind of data. And it's data that is intended to be used by a wide variety of parties. And so that's why governments have grown increasingly interested in metadata, right? Because even if you can't see who I'm messaging on, say, WhatsApp, a Facebook-run Signal alternative, if you can see who I'm messaging, even if you can't see specifically what the messages are, you might still be able to draw a lot of interesting inferences about me. For example, am I communicating with some terrorist in Yemen, or am I, you know, texting my mom? You know, those patterns or those behaviors are very different, and governments can derive interesting insights by looking at metadata without necessarily the content.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about the attempts to weaken encryption or build backdoors into your content, your devices. Probably the most prominent one right now is the attacks we're seeing on Apple itself from the Heat Initiative over what's called CSAM, child sexual abuse material. In general, how are you thinking about the dangers of eroding encryption, and how do you weigh this, you know, argument that seems very effective that many people make, that if you don't have anything to hide, you have nothing to worry about?
You know, it's a good question. The way I think about it is, you know, if you go back 50 years ago, we didn't give our important information to third parties, right? You kept it in a file cabinet in your home. You kept private information physically in your possession in most cases. Today, with the explosion of cloud services, we're turning over reams of information to companies like Google, and they're storing it for us. And when police want to look at your papers, they can just go to Google. I think encryption returns us to something more like we had 50 years ago, right? Where your data is your data. And if the police want to get it, they can't go to Google. They have to come to you. It returns the balance of digital privacy back to the user when it had tilted a little bit too far towards these tech giants who got to decide, you know, when and under what conditions they were going to give your papers, your information over to governments. Encryption takes that out of their hands and puts it back in your hands. It doesn't mean the police can never get information. They often can by seizing your computers, by seizing your phone, by getting a court order to open your device, sometimes by hacking in. But it definitely makes it harder, is a check on government abuse and government power, and puts more power in the hands of individuals. And so that's essentially how I think of encryption. There are perfectly good and legitimate arguments on the other side, right? You talked about CSAM, child sexual abuse material. I mean, this is a serious problem. It's a scourge. It's something that is being traded in encrypted spaces. And Apple was trying to look for a responsible solution that would balance individual privacy with the need to combat this very important problem. But the problem is when you weaken encryption in one instance, even for a good one, that could potentially be used in other cases, right? So take the Apple child abuse scanning system. What it would do is it would essentially scan on your device for evidence that you were trading child sexual abuse material. And then if it found an adequate number of things that it suspected to be child sexual abuse material, then it would flag it to Apple, or actually I think it would flag it to a nonprofit that deals with this and works with law enforcement. The problem is that that exact same technology could be used to scan for dissident materials if you're in an authoritarian country, or it could be used to scan for certain keywords that the state doesn't want you to use. So this technology, which Apple called client-side scanning, is just technology. It's just a tool, and it can be used for purposes that we might deem socially acceptable, or it might be used for purposes that we might deem authoritarian and oppressive. And the concern among civil libertarians rightly was, well, what happens if China wants access to that client-side scanning? What happens if governments want to use it to scan some journalist's phone for evidence that they were talking to some source that had access to classified information? Where do you draw reasonable lines about the use of this tool or technology?
Yeah, you mentioned dissidents. I think we ought to take a pit stop just to talk about what other countries can do with this data, because a lot of the book is about how the U.S. government is buying this data, but they're not the only country that can. So how are you thinking about that, and what other governments could possibly do with the data that you've outlined?
Yeah, it's a great question. So essentially, it's easy for me to write about the United States because we're a relatively free and open society. Our government is subject to the rule of law and laws like FOIA. And a lot of these programs were unclassified. So it was a reporting challenge, but it was possible for me to do this reporting. It's very, very difficult to do it on a country like China or Russia, which are much more closed authoritarian societies. But I can tell you that other governments are doing the same thing with this data. And that's something that I think U.S. government officials are increasingly recognizing. Joe Biden in February signed an executive order that would stop the bulk transfers of data to countries of concern like China and Russia, because they know that what our government can do with data, other governments can also do with data. And those governments are targeting people in the United States, people in the West, who are dissidents, who have spoken out against their policies. And that poses a concern to the security and privacy of people inside of the United States from authoritarian governments around the world.
Let's spend a little time about on what we can do here. It's clear from the book, you don't think the public is aware of the degree of this surveillance and the data that they're giving effectively to the government, ultimately to the government. Where does the blame lie for this? Are mainstream journalists asking the right questions to power? Do they have conflicts due to the way As you very meticulously outlined, technology and media have intertwined business motives. Like, what questions should be asked and to whom?
Yeah, I don't think journalists are falling down on the job per se. I think it's a very complicated topic. It's a new and emerging phenomenon. And increasingly, I think there has been a lot more public attention on this topic from journalists, from civil society, and even increasingly from lawmakers and regulators. I think the big picture question we want to ask is, as a society, what kinds of data do we want the government to obtain and under what circumstances? And I think, you know, lots of people say, well, you know, I have nothing to hide, let the government have my data. But that kind of attitude does tilt the power much more towards the state. I mean, traditionally in the United States, we have limited the power of the state by limiting the amount of information we give the state. When you have this much data available for sale, or in some cases, the taking, that does begin to change the privacy calculation, the power dynamic involved in modern society. And I think the important thing is for consumers to understand, one, what their technology does, where their data goes, and to truly be fully informed about that. And two, to understand how their government uses that data. You know, I don't think there should be secrets in a democracy about either what your technology is doing or what your government is doing with the data that the technology generates. I do think that is corrosive to public trust and isn't the way that we as a democratic society ought to be operating.
You know, after the 9/11 attacks, we got the Patriot Act with bipartisan support, broad bipartisan support. And then after Snowden blew the whistle in 2013, Democrats in particular were up in arms about the extent to which the government was surveilling Americans. Where does the partisanship lie on this topic now? If you had to break it down, is it, you know, does it fall on party lines, or does it fall on a sort of institutional, anti-institutional axis? How would you describe it?
It's a very interesting question. I think if you go back even to the aftermath of 9/11, there has always been a cross-partisan coalition of people who are interested in civil liberties and limiting the power of government. So when Ron Wyden and a few other senators led the movement to defund the Total Information Awareness Program, there were actually representatives of Grover Norquist's group and a couple of other conservative-leaning advocacy groups that stood alongside him. And at the end of the day, lots and lots of Republicans voted to defund this program. We see that in every FISA renewal, right? There was one in 2017, and there is one currently being debated in Congress. This is the landmark foreign surveillance law. It's up for renewal every few years to authorize the government to basically go to providers like Google and demand information about foreign terrorist targets. Every time it's come up for renewal in the last few years, you've seen a very strange bedfellows coalition of left-right advocates coming up and banding together to try to sink this program. And then you see much more national security establishment-oriented Republicans and Democrats defending this program. And so I do think there really is cross-partisan or bipartisan interest in doing something about this huge amalgamation of data that we're all generating and that governments are increasingly accessing. And, you know, I think you saw that in the vote in the Judiciary Committee last summer. On a provision authored again by Ron Wyden called the Fourth Amendment is Not for Sale Act that would essentially ban U.S. government agencies from obtaining this data. And it passed, I think it was 30-0. So, you know, that's the kind of lopsided margin that you get when you know, put up a renaming of a post office bill for, you know, some great American, or, you know, put a right. resolution on the floor, you know, praising apple pie. I mean, that's a pretty, pretty bipartisan statement. Unfortunately, you know, there is a contingent of lawmakers of both parties that are much more national security oriented. And so there is this divide, there is this impasse in Congress over what to do.
You know, outside of Congress, as I was thinking about this toward the end of the book, I couldn't help but think about the sort of money and interest that seems completely asymmetrical to the interests of privacy and protecting the Fourth Amendment. If you think about, you know, if you line up on one side of the table, everybody and every entity that has an interest in the status quo and expanding the scope of surveillance capabilities and the integration of private data collection with sort of government use, you've got, you know, you've got not only these ad tech companies and data brokers that you talk about and cybersecurity firms, you have U.S. intelligence, law enforcement, military, and then behind all of them is everybody everywhere who wants to advertise to someone else or to some audience, to reach an audience to sell anything at all. And the amount of advertising, I don't even have a number off the top of my head, the amount of advertising dollars that are spent every single year, because advertisers naturally are going to gravitate toward more efficient, more effective advertising spend. And that is only enabled by richer, more accurate, precise, real-time data. And so you take all of that money and all that interest and all the lobbyists that they can employ. And to me, I, as somebody who works in this space, I had a difficult time coming up with a very sort of formidable set of allies to put on the other side. Now, there's the Electronic Frontier Foundation. There are some heavy hitters on the other side. But to me, it sort of pales in comparison to the firepower that you can stack on the other side. So I just wonder what your thoughts are about that in general and in the advocacy space when it comes to questions of privacy and surveillance.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think the biggest issue is that advertising, as you said, is, if it's not already a trillion-dollar business, it's rapidly approaching it. You know, hundreds of billions of dollars have been sunk into this system to be able to identify consumers and sell them things. And that's a tremendous economic project that would disrupt the very ways in which online commerce is conducted. So it's a very hard system to unwind, and I think governments are basically just living in a world that advertisers and tech companies have created. Governments didn't create these systems. They're just taking advantage of systems that exist. Mm-hmm. You know, I do think companies are starting to potentially realize it may not be in their commercial or consumer interest to have their advertising systems be seen as a backdoor for government surveillance. So it is possible that tech companies like Apple and Google will move to crack down on this practice of collecting huge amounts of data from smartphones by, you know, sharply limiting the kinds of data that come off of them. It's possible that these consumer advertising companies will do a much better job of vetting who they allow into their ad pools and stopping any entities that have links to, you know, government data brokers or governments from being there. That's a possible direction for reform, I think.
Okay. Well, here's the big picture question that I want to close this sort of main conversation with, and then we'll flip over to Politicology Plus. But if people are now waking up to the astounding vulnerability of our second-by-second interactions, with not just the digital world of texts and taps and calls and locations, but also with the non-digital world as well, which you talk about via smart locks, fitness trackers, the Internet of Things, which is booming. And this isn't the direction we want to go as a society, right? As you said, we're not going to unwind this entire industry. What levers are there to pull? And is our only hope of protecting ourselves to develop tools and advanced technologies that are resistant to surveillance and manipulation? Or is a culture change required? And if so, what would it take to spark one? Or is it both?
I think the big picture question is, what are people in their roles as both consumers and as voters willing to accept? You know, as long as the public has information, understands how their technology works, and is fully read in as a society about what the rules are, you know, I have no problem here. I mean, my aim is only to act as a journalist and to give people good information about what their technology and what their governments are doing. But I do think it's ultimately on people in both their role as a consumer and their role as a voter to decide what they think the rules should be and what they're willing to accept in their consumer technology. And I think that's the only way any of this will change, that if consumers get fed up about the ways in which corporations are collecting data, or if voters seem to be uncomfortable with the direction that government surveillance is going in, then these institutions will respond. If people don't seem to care, I think things will just keep going as they're going now.
Byron Tao, the book is outstanding. Congratulations. Before I let you go, where can everybody find you on the internet, follow your work, and where's the best place to point them to get the book?
Sure. So they could get the book anywhere books are sold, whether that's online or their favorite independent bookstore. You can find me on both Twitter and LinkedIn under @ByronTao. That's B-Y-R-O-N, last name T-A-U. And I currently write for a website called Notus. That's N-O-T-U-S.org. And sorry for, that's a lot of spelling, but that's where you can find me.
We'll link to all of that in the show notes. Byron, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you to everyone at home and on the go for listening today. You can support the show by joining the growing, thriving community of Politicology Plus members and gain access to hours of special content designed to help you think like a political strategist and look further down the road than everyone else and understand the forces and figures shaping the fight for democracy. You can unlock this premium content at politicology.com/plus. If you have any questions about anything we've talked about, you can reach us, as always, at podcast@politicology.com. Even if we can't respond, we do read everything you send us, whether it's an episode idea, a guest recommendation, or just a simple note about how the show has impacted you. And we love hearing from you. I'm Ron Steslow. I'll see you in the next episode.